Hello and welcome to the Institute of Nutritional Endocrinology presentation, Gluten-Free as an Antidote to Low Vitality. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm excited to share this information with you because I think it's really critical information in the care of your clients and really important for you to understand the underlying mechanisms and what goes on in a gluten intolerance that can trigger health problems that are widespread in your clients. And before we begin, as usual, I just want to make sure that you understand that this information is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, and it's certainly not medical advice. And when you're working with your clients, you need to be able to explain to them that you are educating them and you are helping them to assess underlying nutritional imbalances that can create health challenges and encourage them to make healthcare decisions in concert with the qualified health professional, especially if they're on any medication or if they are under the care for any particular diagnosed conditions. So, I decided to put the gluten intolerance module in the section with the micronutrients and in particular under the carbohydrates, and I'll explain why. So far we've looked at water, we've looked at fat, we've looked at protein, and looked at carbohydrates. Gluten is actually a protein. So why would I have put this under the carbohydrate section? Well, the reason is that the foods that contain high levels of gluten, or any gluten at all, are actually your high carbohydrate foods, your starches, your grains. So that's why I decided to put it under the carbohydrate section, because as you're guiding your clients to the proper choice of carbohydrates, how many and which ones to include in their diet, you have to look at the role of gluten in order to make that work. So what are we going to learn here in this module? Well, we'll talk about what gluten is, where it's found, some of the hidden sources of it, what gluten intolerance is, and how it can silently destroy health. We'll also look at the difference between gluten sensitivity, gluten intolerance, gluten allergy, and celiac. So the difference between celiac disease and non-celiac gluten intolerance. What are some of the symptoms of gluten intolerance? How you test to determine if your client is gluten intolerant. There are a number of different tests. And then what do you do to manage clients with gluten intolerance? Yes, avoidance of gluten is a big part of it, but there's also other things that you need to be aware of in order to have your client get the best results from going gluten-free. So let's just get into the truth about gluten and how it can silently destroy your health. Gluten intolerance has been around for a really long time. Celiac disease was diagnosed a long time ago in the early 1900s. The first signs of non-gut-related symptoms that were attributed to gluten were actually in the 1930s, and that was in relationship to brain issues with memory and cognition and things like that. So gluten intolerance has been around for a long time, and it has just become popular over the last, I would say, 5 years or so, where the supermarkets dedicate parts of their shelf space to gluten-free foods. It's gotten to be almost the chic thing to be gluten-free. And then there's the naysayers who say, well, there's no such thing, and it's, you know, celiac disease is gluten intolerance, and it only affects a very small percentage of the population. But indeed, we know that it's way more than celiac disease. It's way more than just gut issues, and it's not a fad. It's real. The mechanisms are real, and there are a lot of well-respected scientists who are staking their careers on studying this and explaining the underlying mechanisms in scientific ways. And while this is a short presentation today, I'm going to give you access to resources, I think, that you owe it to yourself to look into if you want to go deeper and deeper and deeper. So what exactly is gluten anyway? Well, it's actually a protein, or actually a group of proteins, that's found in common grains like wheat, barley, rye, triticale, spelt, and Kamut. And contrary to popular belief, spelt and Kamut, which are ancient grains, they're ancient forms of wheat, they are not gluten-free. And a lot of people think that they can just switch from wheat to spelt or Kamut and have the benefits of going gluten-free. And indeed, that's not the case for most people. So it's a protein, and gluten is actually, there's fractions, subfractions of the gluten protein, gliadin and a number of others. And we'll talk a little bit more about what those fractions are when we talk about the testing, the lab testing. So it's basically, it's found in pretty much all the foods that most Americans eat. Most Americans probably eat about 75% of their calories from gluten. Between the bread and the cereal and the muffins and the croissants for breakfast, the sandwiches, the wraps, the pizzas for lunch, and of course, don't forget the pasta dishes, and then again, the pasta dishes for dinner, the bread before each meal, and the dessert after the meal. So add it all up. The majority of what people are eating is gluten. And no wonder we're all exhausted and there's so many health problems that abound. The gluten grains, where are they found? So, you know, when you talk to your clients and you just say, well, avoid wheat, avoid barley, avoid gluten, they don't really know where these things are going to be found. So this is a very partial, very short list of where gluten grains can be found. In addition, there's a booklet that you have access to, and you can give access to your clients via opting in on my website to get their free booklet, and it's got a very, very detailed list of all the hidden places that gluten can be found. But wheat, well, wheat is pretty obvious. It's all over the place. Breads and tortillas, obvious, right? The other place that people think, it's funny, people just think that Ezekiel bread and Essene bread, which are sprouted grain breads, are actually okay if you have a gluten problem. And indeed, they actually might be worse because in addition to the gluten, the presence of the gluten, there are actually some other compounds and partial intermediate compounds that get produced during the sprouting process that could actually make Ezekiel and Essene breads worse. When your clients say to you, oh, no, I don't eat any bread, I'm gluten-free, you can't take it at face value. You need to start digging and asking them questions and get very, very, very specific. In fact, having a checklist that you can give them that they could check off all the things that they do eat will give you an idea. You'd be surprised at how many people I talk to who say, you know, I've been gluten-free for about 2 years. And then I start asking them questions, and it turns out they're actually eating gluten once or twice a week. But it's just little bits here and there, and it makes a huge difference. So under the wheat, like I said, breads and tortillas, Ezekiel and Essene bread, any baked goods, unless they specifically say gluten-free, have gluten in them. And they're made with wheat, they're made with rye, they're made with other grains. Couscous. People just think, well, what is couscous? You know, you go to a Middle Eastern restaurant and you get couscous, or you get tabbouleh. Tabbouleh is another one. Where is hidden source of wheat? People think, don't even relate that to wheat. They're thinking breads and pastas, when in reality it's hidden all over. Soups. A lot of places use wheat flour to thicken their soups. And unless they specifically tell you it's gluten-free, do not assume that the vegetable soup that you get at your favorite restaurant is actually gluten-free. Most likely it's not. It's pretty easy when you're reading cans and you're going to read the ingredients. But when you're in a restaurant and you just assume that the vegetable soup is safe and is gluten-free, you may get yourself in trouble. So this is stuff to warn your clients about. Pasta, obviously, cereals, all the cereals, most of the cereals. You know, Rice Krispies might be gluten-free. I'm not sure. You'd need to read them because a lot of things you think are corn, like cornbread, for example. Cornbread has usually got a high percentage of wheat flour in it. Sauces and gravies, again, it's used as thickeners. You know, I used to watch my mom make fresh gravy and sauces on the stove for Thanksgiving or special holidays, and she would always put the flour in there to thicken it up. And surprisingly, salad dressings often contain wheat. Oftentimes they contain tamari or soy sauce, which contains wheat. So there's just so many places where these things are found. Barley. Well, barley malt is a common sweetener. It's considered a lower glycemic sweetener and a better sweetener. Used a lot in macrobiotic cooking, and it's got the malt of the barley, which has gluten in it. Barley is also used in food coloring. Soup, it's very common to get vegetable barley soup, and people don't think about barley being a gluten grain. Malt vinegar, made from barley, and beer, made from barley. So I remember talking to people when they first discovered they're gluten-free, and they go, it's no big deal. I don't eat that much pasta. I don't eat that much bread. So what about beer? Do you drink beer? And then it's like freak out time. Oh, my God, I have to give up my beer, too. Well, there are gluten-free beers that exist these days. I'm not sure how good that is or if it's even something worth recommending to people, but certainly if they have a gluten intolerance and they are insisting on drinking beer, you just have them do the gluten-free beer. Spelt and kamut, which are ancient grains, they're non-hybridized versions of wheat. A lot of times people wonder, well, why is gluten so bad? Why are people so sensitive to gluten? And a lot of the reason is that the wheat has been hybridized and bred to contain more and more gluten to give it that nice mouthfeel, that nice, you know, doughy consistency. The ancient grains have a lot less gluten, and it's a different format. But the point is, because we've become sensitized to the wheat, to the common stuff, even the other stuff is problematic. So things like, you know, kamut and spelt bread, pastas, cereals, and sprouted raw breads that are wheat-free are not gluten-free when they contain spelt and kamut. And the same thing with rye. Rye is common, you know, as bread. People don't think about rye being gluten. But also pumpernickel bread contains gluten, as well as rye beer and a variety of cereals. So this, like I said, is not an exhaustive list, but it's certainly a place to start when you're looking to guide your clients to get off of the gluten. Now we know what gluten is. We know where gluten's found, and it's probably just a review for you, but it serves to be repeated. But what exactly is gluten intolerance? Well, gluten intolerance is the inability to digest properly gluten and the reaction that the body has to it. There's several ways that the body can react to gluten. One is actually an allergy, which causes an immune system response, and we'll go into detail about that now. Another is to be sensitive to it, and it may not involve the immune system, but just that it's inflammatory. Gluten is actually inflammatory for most people. So there's a lot of things. And some of the scientists that are studying this say that nobody actually digests gluten because it's been so hybridized and it's such a hard molecule to digest. In order to understand the mechanism of gluten intolerance, I think it's important for you to understand a little bit about how the immune system works. Your immune system is the surveillance system of the body, and it's constantly out there putting a pulse on what's coming into the body and what it has to do to protect. So foreign invaders are actually, aka proteins, foreign proteins, aka antigens. So the foreign invaders are identified by the police department and the army of the body, aka the immune system. So whenever a foreign protein gets into the bloodstream, it causes the immune system to go on alert. So what could those foreign proteins be? Well, they could be the obvious of bacteria and viruses and fungi and yeasts, which are things that we want the body to keep out, right? We don't want foreign microorganisms to invade the body. Great thing for the immune system to attack these. It also can attack molds. So if there's a lot of mold in the environment, people are living in moldy, musty homes, or if your car has gotten wet and that the upholstery has not been able to appropriately dry out, you may have mold growing there. You may have molds growing in your refrigerator. There's a lot of ways that you can be in a moldy environment. Molds growing carpets and in the underlying pads that go underneath carpets, and I know a lot of folks get very bad reactions from work situations where there's a lot of mold and they can't really survive well at work. So that's one of the things that the immune system will attack. Also pollen. which is like, okay, pollen is really not a foreign invader, but when it gets into the system and the system is a little bit confused, it can treat it as if it's a bacteria. Food particles. Food particles are not supposed to get into the bloodstream. Here, that's the wrap. Food particles are supposed to stay in the digestive tract. They're supposed to be digested, broken down, absorbed through the lining of the digestive tract as tiny, tiny particles, the little building blocks, like we've talked about, the building blocks of the foods. The monosaccharides from your starches, the amino acids from your proteins, and the fatty acids from your bigger fat molecules. So those go into the bloodstream. But when there's an issue with the barrier of the gut, the barrier between the outside world and the inside world, really, because the inside of your digestive tract is actually still the outside world. When the particles that are not fully digested are able to penetrate through that lining, we get a reaction of the immune system. And that's one of the things, one of the proteins that the immune system can react to. In addition, there's dirt, there's parasites, there's environmental toxins. All of these things can get into the system and create an immune system attack. So when gluten gets into the bloodstream, when the gluten molecules do not get fully broken down into their constituent amino acids, and it's recognizable in the bloodstream as a foreign protein, the body attacks. In addition, if we have a buildup of specific types of antibodies called IgA antibodies that live in the lining of the digestive tract, that live in that barrier. And as soon as anything starts to go through it, it immediately puts a reaction in. So it doesn't even have to get into the bloodstream. The reaction can actually start in the intestines. So let's look at antibodies, because antibodies are the constituents of the immune system. They're also known as immunoglobulins, and they're proteins. They're a specific class of protein. And there's various types of antibodies. And most people don't think about the types of antibodies. They just think about antibodies. Antibodies are antibodies are antibodies. But there's actually different types. IgM and IgD, that's immunoglobulin M and immunoglobulin D, are the first line of defense. They're what comes into play early on in an infectious process. IgGs are the most prevalent in the blood. They're usually more of a delayed sensitivity, that they react a little bit later than the IgAs and the IgEs. The IgAs are in the mucosal surfaces, so in your secretions, in your respiratory tract, along your digestive tract, in the vagina, any place where there's moist mucosal type surfaces, the IgA are lining there to protect. The IgEs line the respiratory and the GI mucosal reactions, and their immediate sensitivity, and they produce or trigger the response to produce histamine. And histamine is actually it's actually a chemical reaction. It's like, think of it as the ammunition of the immune system that causes the reactions that you see in acute allergic reactions, like hives and swelling in the skin and things like that. So food allergies can either be immediate or delayed. And generally, the immunoglobulins that would be involved would be IgA in the mucous membranes. So IgA, say, in the gut lining, in the respiratory tract, the lungs, and in the nose. The IgEs, which do the immediate attack and produce histamine immediately. And those are people who eat a strawberry, get hives. There's almost no time that goes by in between. Whereas with the IgAs and the IgGs, there's more of a delay. The IgGs are delayed hypersensitivity, and sometimes you don't even see a reaction related to an IgG for a day or two or up to 4 days after the exposure. And that's measured in the bloodstream. And the mistake that's made a lot of times is that we test for allergies by just testing IgGs. And in reality, you may not have an IgG response to something, but you may have an IgA or an IgE. And then there's IgMs, which we don't hear about too much and are not actually measured all that much, although there are some tests that do measure for them. And those happen early in an allergic response. So now would be a good time to distinguish between a food sensitivity and a food allergy. A food allergy is a situation where this immune response that I just described is happening. There are immunoglobulins that are out there attacking the food in question. A food sensitivity is where your body just doesn't handle a food too well. It could be an allergy, but it could also be something like maybe you don't make the right digestive enzymes to break it down, or maybe there's a particular fiber in that food that's aggravating or irritating or inflammatory to you. Frequently, both food allergies and food sensitivities are caused by a leaky gut. And you already know what a leaky gut is, right? It's when the membrane that lines the intestinal tract that's supposed to keep the outside world from the inside world, it gets damaged, it gets inflamed. And the villi and the microvilli that line the gut get damaged and inflamed and sometimes flattened. And when that happens, it causes an increased permeability of the intestinal lining. A lot of times, gluten sensitivity causes a dampening, a deadening, a shrinking of those intestinal microvilli and creates inflammation. And then you develop additional food allergies and sensitivities as a result of the damage caused by the gut's reaction to the first one. It's quite complex. This is what the cell membrane looks like of a mast cell. And a mast cell is a histamine-producing cell, and it gets involved in allergic-type reactions. So we have the whole arachidonic acid cascade, which we talked in depth about in our fatty acid module, where we talked a lot about fats and how the fats produce either inflammation or anti-inflammatory. So that's in the mast cell membrane. This is a review of the inflammatory cascade. We have our essential fats at the top, linoleic on the left-hand side, which is an omega-6, and alpha-linolenic on the right-hand side, which is an omega-3. We have the delta-60 saturase enzyme, which elongates those fatty acids into EPA-DHA on the omega-3 side, or GLA on the omega-6 side. And then it comes down and either results in inflammation or lack of inflammation or anti-inflammation. The omega-3s are always anti-inflammatory. The omega-6s can go either way. When there's an excess of linoleic acid in the diet, it pushes the reaction down from GLA to DGLA into arachidonic acid, which is inflammatory. Or if we have the right balance, it can produce PG1, which is an anti-inflammatory prostaglandin. This is just a review. For more details, go review the fat module. Again, a review of what kind of things can help. And these are the same things that help in inflammation, can also help in a gluten response. And the more you have a built-up fatty acid cascade, the better your response is going to be to any kind of immune assault or attack. So we've got our flax seeds, chia seeds, hemp seeds, walnuts, fish, marine algae on the right-hand side for omega-3. On the left-hand side, we have very abundant foods, which would be sesame seeds, sunflower seeds, almond, pumpkin. And then the less common, which would be more supplemental type oils, which provide GLA, like borage and black currant and evening primrose. And it has to do with the balance of these things plus the nutrients that support the delta-60 saturase enzyme, your B vitamins, vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc, magnesium. All of these are important for dampening the inflammation that occurs as a result of food intolerance and, in particular, gluten intolerance. So let's look at the widespread symptoms that gluten intolerance can cause. Pretty much it's a great mimicker, and it can create damage throughout the entire body. So let's look. Well, first of all, it can cause weight gain or weight loss. How can that be? How can it cause both? Well, it can cause weight loss if it triggers diarrhea, and the diarrhea causes you to lose the stool and lose all the contents of the food as it's being eaten. So when gluten intolerance is damaging the gut, and it results in chronic diarrhea, it can lead to weight loss. For the most part, it usually leads to weight gain because of the inflammation. Nutritional deficiencies These result from malabsorption. The gluten intolerance leads to inflammation in the gut and subsequent malabsorption. So you can get low iron levels, low B12 levels, low vitamin C, B vitamins. Any and all nutritional deficiencies can result from gluten intolerance. Of course, there's the typical gastrointestinal problems, bloating, pain, gas, constipation, and diarrhea. All of the above can be caused by gluten intolerance and fat in the stools due to poor digestion. Now, these are specific to the gut. And I'm going to tell you that a lot of times the gut symptoms of gluten intolerance are the later ones. And a lot of people mistakenly will say to you, hey, I don't have gluten intolerance. I eat gluten. I don't get a bellyache. I don't get bloated. You've got to dig deeper and look at what some of the other issues are and the other problems that they're having, because gluten can go way beyond the gut. And in some people, the gut stuff is last. A lot of times it starts with the brain and more systemic things, like aching joints. Can cause things that mimic rheumatoid arthritis, or actually can cause things like rheumatoid arthritis and other kinds of joint issues. Depression. A lot of times I've gotten people off of gluten, and within days to weeks, they were reducing their depression medications, which is pretty phenomenal. Eczema, or chicken skin, you know, that's on the back of the arms where the skin looks really bumpy, or eczema. People just don't associate it with gluten. And there's a particular type of dermatitis, which is inflammation of the skin, called dermatitis herpetiformis. Herpetiformis, which is very classic for gluten. So skin problems. When you've got somebody who has skin problems, you've got to think gluten intolerance. For some people, it's headaches. And it may or may not be shortly after consuming. It could be up to 3 or 4 days later. It can cause exhaustion and it can cause brain fog. And the thing about these symptoms is, once you have a gluten exposure, if you're super sensitive, the symptoms can linger for months. So people may think, oh yeah, I'm gluten intolerant, but you know, every now and then, every week or two, I have a little bit of gluten. What's happening is that every time your client goes off the gluten, the symptoms will subside and healing of the gut starts to happen. But every time they reintroduce it, everything gets flared up again. And it can actually take up to 6 months for all the symptoms to fully go down. And it's just, to me, it's just not worth it. And really, when you're counseling people, it's important for you to really explain this to them, that occasional gluten exposure is not okay. So let's talk about a few other symptoms of gluten intolerance. Here's some that most people have no idea is related. Infertility, irregular menstrual cycles, and even miscarriage. The literature abounds with studies that link these to gluten intolerance. Now, does everybody with gluten intolerance have these symptoms? No. Does everybody with these symptoms have gluten intolerance? Not necessarily, but it's up to you to educate and inform your clients that this is a possibility, so that you can do whatever it takes to rule it out and get them on the road to recovery. It can result in neurologic symptoms. Among those are cramping, tingling, and numbness. Cramping in the muscles, tingling, and numbness. It causes slow infant and child growth. Well, that's a pretty obvious one, right? If somebody's not digesting and absorbing properly, the kid is not going to grow. And that's a failure to thrive is a symptom that's really common. And you'd be surprised at how many conventional doctors miss it. I remember working with a mom who had a son who was showing signs of Asperger's disease, which is on the autistic spectrum. And the doctor said, hey, you know, he's slow to develop and blah, blah, blah. And the kid was underweight for his size and he had diarrhea. Did that doctor even consider that it was gluten intolerance? No, the mom had to start doing research, came to see me, we investigated it. Sure enough, yeah, the kid had gluten intolerance. Within a year, on a gluten-free diet and taking extra supplements to rebuild his gut, this kid went back to the doctor, who said, wow, this child is a little bit above normal in intelligence. It's amazing how often it's overlooked. And you're going to be inclined to go to the root, to try to find the root of a problem closer to where the problem is. In other words, I've had people say to me, oh, somebody had, you know, somebody came in with particular inflammatory condition. And right away you're trying to solve that problem. But really you have to remember, underneath the roots, the roots, the roots, the roots. And gluten intolerance needs to be investigated in anybody with any chronic health challenges, regardless of where it is, because it can be, it's the great mimicker, like I said. And if you're working with somebody with thyroid problems, if you're working with someone with inflammatory problems, if you're working with someone with hormonal imbalances, you've got to think gluten and get the gluten out to be able to test it. Other symptoms, irritability and behavioral changes, early onset of Parkinson's. How many people who think, oh, I've got Parkinson's, it's really depressing, are actually gluten intolerant? And this is damage that's been happening for years, even Alzheimer's, and of course, autism and ADHD. I did a research paper, which I'm going to give you a copy of in the extra document section of the page, and it was all about the autistic spectrum, neurodevelopmental diseases and conditions in children and the relationship to gluten. It's a very enlightening paper with about 65 different resources and references. And finally, let's look at the last slide of symptoms of gluten intolerance, thyroid problems. If someone presents to you and they say they're on Synthroid or any other kind of thyroid medication, you've got to immediately think gluten intolerance. And you've also got to immediately, of course, check their antibodies. Especially in conditions where there's thyroid antibodies, it's a must to get them off of gluten. Same thing with insulin resistance. Insulin resistance is triggered by and made worse by continuing to use gluten. In addition to the fact that gluten is a grain and it causes a high glycemic effect, it's the inflammatory effect and the effect it has on the pancreas and on the GAD receptors in the pancreas, the GAD enzymes, and it actually can create and trigger insulin antibodies. So you really have to look at gluten intolerance when you're looking at insulin resistance. Diabetes, insulin resistance, diabetes, again, on a continuum. Any autoimmune disease, you've got to look at underlying root of gluten intolerance and get people off of gluten to test it. Crohn's disease, for sure. Crohn's is an inflammatory gut response, and it's amazing how many people respond when they get off of gluten and dairy, when they get off of all the processed foods, when they get onto good fats, and they go on a healing regime. And finally, any kind of hormone imbalances, whether it's thyroid, adrenal, reproductive hormone imbalances, PMS, menopausal symptoms, all of these things can be related to gluten intolerance. And like I said, it's a great mimicker. You've got to work with this gluten-free diet to help these folks. So let's look at how you test for gluten intolerance. In some cases, people don't want to spend the money to get tested. They just say, okay, it's probably true. I'm just going to go off the gluten. And that's a great way to do it. I personally have never been tested for gluten intolerance. I know I'm intolerant. I don't want to waste my money. I know I'm going to stay away from it at all costs. For some people, though, it's not so straightforward. They may be good about the diet at first, but then they may say, well, just a little bit. Once they're better, just a little bit. And if they haven't been tested to confirm whether or not they have the gluten intolerance and whether they have the gene, they may start to cheat, and then over time, their symptoms are going to recur. So let's take a look at some of the tests we can do. First of all, an elimination diet. You can eliminate the suspects, like gluten in this case, and I would also be eliminating any foods that are known to be cross-reactive with gluten. Dairy is one of them. Let's see, there's a whole list of them. Hemp seeds, sesame seeds, quinoa, rice. And it doesn't mean that the person is going to be cross-reactive, but if you're going to be doing an elimination diet, I would certainly eliminate those. Fasting is one way to eliminate the suspects. Fasting completely just on water. Not very many people are going to want to do that. And I list it as a medical food because it would be a meal replacement type food. And there's some of them that come from various supplement companies like Thorne and Metagenics, and they have things like Ultra Clear and MediClear and all that that are formulated specifically to be full of the nutrients that someone would need that they could live on 4 or 5 servings of that a day. But you can also make up your own. You can use any kind of really high-quality protein powder along with greens powders and any other additional nutrients you feel people need. But I usually find that the combination of protein powder with a green powder can work real well. The other thing you can do is juicing. Juicing can be fine, too, just vegetable juice, so you're off of all the grains and the dairy and all the suspicious-type foods. And then the last thing would be a rare foods diet, where you have somebody go on a diet of just foods that they eat hardly ever, and then after the days you're going to introduce foods. So this is an elimination diet. You can use it for gluten intolerance. You can also use it for a general food allergy testing. The provocation protocol is one new food at a time, and there's the 3-day rule. What does that mean? Well, you add a food, and then you watch and observe for 3 days. You eat a lot of that food over 3 days. And if you don't see a change, or your client doesn't see a change in how they feel over that 3 days, then they're free to add that food back in, assume that it's not a problem, and then go and do the next food. If in over the course of those 3 days there's any suspicious symptoms, a return of symptoms that had gone away during the elimination phase, then you know that there's a problem. When you are doing this, I highly recommend that you do not test gluten after the 3 days. You do not test dairy after that time. You test the other foods that you think are possibly suspicious. Now, you're assuming that over the course of this elimination diet that a person feels better. If they don't, then it could be that there's been a lot of damage from the food intolerances, in particular from the gluten intolerance. You may have to start working on healing their gut before you can actually have a successful provocation period. There's a program called the Food Allergy Spy Training that I offer. It has materials, and that has all the guidelines for doing an elimination diet. So when we get into testing, actually testing other than doing elimination diet, you can look at blood antibody food tests. Personally, I haven't found these to be especially reliable, especially for gluten. I find that people tend to, especially if they've been away from the food for a while, these tests generally won't show up. They're going to actually show active antibody reactions. So they basically, you take a vial of blood. Usually they measure either just IgG, which is a delayed sensitivity, or IgG and IgE. Quite frankly, IgEs, a person's going to know about. And usually glutens are not related to IgEs, they're related to IgAs and IgGs. So you basically are going to test the blood to see if there's an antibody reaction to the particular food, in this case gluten, or the other cross-reactives to gluten. Some labs offer IgAs and IgMs. There's one lab that offers a whole panel, IgA, IgM, IgG, and IgE, and it costs about $1,400 to get about 120 foods done. If you want to just do gluten, this is not what I would recommend. I would not recommend doing just pure IgG. We'll talk about a lab that does gluten testing and is much more reliable gluten blood testing in a moment. A lot of times, if a person, you do a food antibody test and the person shows up with a lot of positives, it's usually related to having a leaky gut. The reason that it's related to a leaky gut is that all of these undigested food molecules are being absorbed through the damaged membrane. Now, if you were to take the person off of all the foods that showed up in the test, and then they started eating other foods on a regular basis repeatedly, the next time you did the test, those new foods that they started eating a lot more of are going to show up. So it's just a really challenging way to do it. Another blood test that's pretty popular is called the ALCAT food intolerance test. And they don't actually measure antibody reactions. They measure the cellular response. How do your cells respond? They test about 350 foods, chemicals, and herbs. They do test for gluten. They do test for dairy. What I've found is when I do these blood tests with people, inevitably we put them on an elimination diet. We go back and retest, and the foods have shifted some of the foods that they were mildly allergic to, they got more allergic to, and vice versa. So I really don't have a lot of confidence in doing food allergy testing this way. I think elimination diets are the best, and a couple of the other tests through Cyrex Labs are also pretty good, and the stool tests. So we'll talk about those in a moment. My favorite test for gluten intolerance by far is also the least expensive, is the Entera Labs stool antibody test. If you just measure anti-gliadin antibodies in the stool, then it's about $99 to do the test. Gliadin is only one of the subfractions of gluten that could be tested for. So if you get a negative, it might be a false negative, and then you might want to invest in a little bit more expensive test that tests all the fractions from Cyrex Labs. They also test some of the possible things that can cross-react, like eggs and dairy and peanuts, and I think there's about 4 or 5 of them that they do, and then they have a more extensive panel of IgA stool antigens, which I think are a little bit more reliable than the blood at IgGs in my experience. They also can measure inflammatory markers, and they can also measure to see if a person has the genetic markers for gluten intolerance, the HLA-DQs. So the gluten subfractions reactivity, this is an array from Cyrex Labs. It's called Array 3. It's a blood test, and they assess gluten reactivity in 12 different fractions, not just gliadin. So the gluten is composed of many subproteins, and most of the tests just test for the gliadin, which is the one that the majority of people are sensitive to, but not necessarily all. So if you just test an IgG for gliadin, a lot of people are going to have a false negative. The problem with doing these tests is that you have to have had recent exposure to gluten in order for them to be positive. So if somebody's been off of gluten for a while, it really, to me, feels almost cruel to make them go back on gluten just so you can run a test and then run the risk of them having massive symptom coming about. The Cyrex Array 3 will test not just IgGs, but also will test IgAs. So that makes it more sensitive than just the tests that do IgAs. And plus, it measures all the different subfractions. Cyrex Labs also has a test. It's called Array 4, which is for cross-reactivity. It's basically testing for reactivity of a number of foods that have been found to cross-react with gluten. And the list is here on the screen. Barley spelt Polish wheat, that's not even really a cross-reactivity. That's actually, they contain gluten. Cow's milk, casein, both alpha and beta casein, caseomorphin, milk butyrophilin, whey protein. So testing all the individual components of the dairy. Chocolate, which I think is a really silly thing for them to be testing because it's milk chocolate. So it's just really testing milk. Oats, yeast, coffee, sesame, buckwheat, sorghum, millet, hemp, amaranth, quinoa, tapioca, teff, soy, egg, corn, rice, and potato. So you can take this list, and if you're designing an elimination diet for somebody who you suspect cross-reactivity, if they don't want to spend the $200 to get the test done, you can do an elimination diet and have them eliminate all of these foods and then gradually add them back one at a time. So the purpose of doing a gluten cross-reactivity test is that a lot of people, up to 30% it's estimated, don't get results when they just go off gluten, even though they're gluten sensitive. Why? Because they're continuing to have an immune response to the foods that cross-react. It measures foods that are known to cross-react with gluten, so it's a good thing to do. And a large percentage of people that are sensitive to gluten are also sensitive to casein, which is milk protein, and some of the other milk proteins. And I've heard the estimates go anywhere from 50 to up to 80% of people who are sensitive to gluten are also sensitive to some portion of the dairy. What's the story for managing gluten intolerance? Is it as simple as taking people off of gluten? Obviously, from what you've heard, it's not. It's a little bit more complicated than that because, number one, there could be cross-reactive foods. So just taking them off of gluten may not give the full results. Number two, from years of gluten intolerance, the person may have a leaky gut, inflammation in the gut, and that needs to be addressed as well as the gluten avoidance. Okay? So, number one, it's strict avoidance. Strict. And I'm going to give you access to a resource that has a very detailed list of all the hidden sources, not only in food, but in cosmetics. Because remember, some of the molecules that are in the cosmetics are going to penetrate into the skin, through the skin, and get into the bloodstream. So you have to be careful about what people are using on their skin, what soaps they're using, what shampoos they're using, what makeup they're using, etc. And a lot of these makeups and shampoos and conditioners do contain gluten. So it's really important to manage their life to completely avoid the gluten. Now, what about just having them go off of gluten and go on all these gluten-free products? So getting gluten-free muffins and gluten-free cereal and gluten-free bread and gluten-free pasta and you name it, gluten-free. Well, I think when you do that, you run the risk of not getting the full benefit of going gluten-free, because a lot of those products, number one, have cross-reactive ingredients like eggs and rice and dairy products. And number two, they're very refined, and most of them have some sort of either refined flour or sugar or both. So you're actually creating a problem and not solving a problem of insulin resistance and sugar intolerance as well. So it's really important to get people off of the gluten, but make sure they're doing things to heal their gut. We'll have a very detailed presentation and protocol for healing leaky gut. And restoring integrity, making sure that they're on enzymes and probiotics and foods that are anti-inflammatory for the gut and to heal it, and mucilaginous, etc. So there's a lot of work we can do for healing the gut. So it's avoiding gluten in every aspect of life, food, environment, sprays in the air, clothing, etc. And then it's healing the leaky gut, and then avoiding the cross-reactive foods, and increasing the level of nutrition in the body to support all these pathways and all the healing. So a lot more of your green leafy vegetables and your omega-3 fats and a lot of the foods that are just really intended to bring up the level of integrity in the body. So I have a resource that you'll have a link to. It's a little booklet that I put together called Eliminate the Gluten and Accelerate Your Health. It's a transcript from a talk that I did. It's got resources, recipes, and hidden source of gluten and dairy lists. So I encourage you to utilize that, to encourage your clients to get that, or create something like that of your own for your clients. But it's important that you think gluten whenever somebody appears in your doorstep with chronic problems that don't seem to be going away. So thank you so much.